Search and rescue operations underway after a powerful earthquake leaves thousands of people dead in Turkey and Syria. Another Palestinian falls victim to Israeli violence. The teenager dies of wounds after being shot by Israeli regime forces in the occupied West Bank. Also ahead, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un pledges to expand and intensify military drills and strengthen the country's war readiness posture. Thank you for joining us. It's a somber day in Turkey and Syria as the number of victims of an earthquake that jolted the two countries on Monday is now increasing by the hour. In Turkey, the death toll has risen to nearly 3,400. That's according to the country's Disaster and Emergency Management Authority. Rescue crews are racing against time to find those who might have survived the natural disaster, but the freezing weather is hampering their efforts. The 7.8 magnitude earthquake had its epicenter in southern Turkey. It also shook northern Syria, killing more than 800 people there. The affected regions in the two countries have also witnessed dozens of major aftershocks. Several thousand buildings have been toppled in the quake-hit cities. Earlier, our correspondent Rashan Saglam joined us from Istanbul for an update on the massive earthquake.
Yes, as you mentioned, it's a very powerful earthquake. Since 40 years, we haven't witnessed such an earthquake in Turkey, not even the one that took place in 1990, the Izmit earthquake, which left 17,000 near the city of Istanbul and kind of vanished whole districts in Istanbul and Izmit area and Yalova, of course. Now, let me mention some information about this earthquake. It happened at 4:17 exactly in the morning in an area called Pazarcık, exactly some kilometers away from Kahramanmaraş. The center of this earthquake was in Kahramanmaraş, so the city of Kahramanmaraş was really affected by it, and it's the most affected by it. Another aftermath took place at 4:26 in the morning in Nurdağ area. It's some 80 kilometers away from the industrial city of Gaziantep, and we know that Gaziantep is bordering Syria. That's why the Syrian borders and cities inside Syria were affected by the earthquake because of the aftermath that took place over there.
We spoke to our correspondent in Damascus, Muhammad Ali, about the situation in Syria's quake-hit regions. He says the biggest challenge is accommodating those who have become homeless due to the devastating earthquake.
First of all, according to the Ministry of Health, the death toll reached 764, as well as 1,448 is the number of the injured as a result of this earthquake. Now, also, we have some humanitarian assistance coming into the country. Iran sent humanitarian assistance. An Iranian airplane landed in the early hours of the morning in Damascus International Airport, loaded with about 45 tons of humanitarian assistance, mainly blankets, food, and medicine. According to Iran's ambassador to Syria, there will be two more additional Iranian airplanes, one landing in Aleppo and another in Latakia, also loaded with humanitarian assistance. There is also two Iraqi airplanes that also landed in Damascus, loaded each with 70 tons of humanitarian assistance. Meanwhile, search and rescue operations continue in northern Syria, mainly in Aleppo and Latakia and its countryside. Ambulance vehicles as well as trucks distributing for the needy all of their needs, like basic needs like food and medicine, also blankets. Maybe the difficulty is actually with the large number of people that have become homeless as a result of the collapses and the earthquake. The challenge now is to provide as much as possible of temporary shelter centers for those in need, and this is what is happening. Schools have been turned into temporary shelter centers.
Staying with this developing news, Iran has sent its aid to Syria to support victims of the deadly earthquake that hit the Arab country on Monday. An Iranian plane carrying aid touched down at Damascus International Airport in the early hours of Tuesday. The aircraft was carrying 45 tons of supplies. Tehran had earlier expressed its readiness to send relief aid to both Turkey and Syria. Other countries have also vowed to assist. Russia says 300 military personnel deployed to Syria are already helping with the clear-up effort. And the European Union says its member states have mobilized over 10 search and rescue teams for Turkey. The UN says its staff are now on the ground in Turkey and Syria to assess the needs and provide assistance.
The United Nations is mobilizing to support the emergency response, and so let's work together in solidarity to assist all those hit by this disaster, many of whom were already in dire need of humanitarian aid. It is time for all of us to show the same solidarity that I've witnessed in the area in relation to refugees fleeing one of the most difficult conflicts of our time. Another clock turned, the so-called doomsday clock.
Pledges of assistance have also been made by other countries across Europe, Asia, West Asia, as well as North America. Turkey says 45 countries have so far offered help with search and rescue efforts. The World Health Organization says it has activated its network of emergency medical teams. They will deliver essential care to the injured and the most vulnerable victims. Turning elsewhere, a young Palestinian teenager wounded in an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank has succumbed to his injuries. According to Palestinian Health Ministry, 17-year-old Hamza al-Ashgar was shot in the face by Israeli forces in Nablus. The incident happened during a raid by the regime's forces on a neighborhood east of the city a day earlier, when Israeli forces killed five Palestinians in the West Bank city of Jericho. The regime has intensified its crackdown against Palestinians, especially after several Israelis were killed in a retaliatory attack outside the synagogue on January 27. The clampdown has killed 44 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank so far this year. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has wrapped up his week-long visit to Latin American countries. During the meetings, the top Iranian diplomat discussed ways to enhance Tehran's cooperation with countries such as Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian is on the final leg of his trip to Latin America, where he has met with a number of high-ranking officials in an effort to boost bilateral and multilateral relations. Cuba was the latest destination of Amir Abdollahian, where he met with Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel. During a meeting, they discussed matters of mutual interest at bilateral and international levels. The top Iranian diplomat voiced his country's categorical support for Havana while condemning sanctions on Cuba and foreign intervention in its internal affairs. Díaz-Canel, for his part, said despite all the existing pressures, Cuba is determined to cooperate with friendly countries and work with them to eliminate obstacles and challenges lying ahead. The Cuban president criticized U.S. unilateralism and said that his country has earned political independence at a high price and would preserve it. Amir Abdollahian also met with his Cuban counterpart, Bruno Rodriguez Parilla. both diplomats wrapped the U.S. sanctions policy against others, including Iran and several South American countries, saying such a policy is doomed to fail. Before Cuba, the top Iranian diplomat paid a visit to Venezuela, which is maintaining strong bilateral relations with Tehran. During a meeting between Amir Abdullahian and Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, the two sides discussed ways to strengthen cooperation further in various fields, including energy. They also called for heightened vigilance in the face of U.S.-led pressure and bullying. Maduro also pointed to common challenges being faced by Venezuela and Iran. Amir Abdullahian also traveled to Nicaragua as part of his Latin American trip. In a meeting with President Daniel Ortega, he condemned all lawful sanctions imposed by the U.S. and certain Western countries on Iranian individuals and entities. He stressed, however, that the Islamic Republic has managed to move forward despite the coercive measures designed to stop the country's progress. Amir Abdullahian voiced Tehran's eagerness for closer cooperation in various fields, saying Iran sets no limits to the promotion of cooperation with Nicaragua. Ortega, for his part, highlighted shared concerns of Tehran and Managua. He said that the two countries have a common enemy, adding that what Iran fought and defeated in 1979 was the same Nicaraguans rose up against in the same year.
And the Latin American visit by Iran's foreign minister highlights the need for countries like Iran, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, and even Brazil to form an alliance to stand against U.S. hegemony and unilateralism. Latin American countries are not the only ones that, but even many African countries are eager to enhance ties with the East, namely Iran, Russia, and China.
Amir Abdullahian's visit to Latin America puts under the spotlight the significance of his meeting with officials there. One of the most important points highlighted by almost all leaders was that the ongoing developments in Latin America and elsewhere in the world are creating new opportunities for multilateralism. That was particularly underlined by the top Iranian diplomat, who dismissed unilateralism as an obsolete doctrine on the global stage. He stressed that unilateralism cannot respond to developments and changes taking place worldwide. In the case of Iran and Venezuela, the officials of the two OPEC members found a common ground to solidify their relations to deal with a common enemy, the United States, which has come up with crippling sanctions against them for years. Standing against the U.S. and Western imperialism was another topic of discussion during the Iranian official's visit. That was underscored in Daniel Ortega's comments, where he said the enemies of global peace and tranquility have maintained their imperialistic policies and considered the whole world, not just Latin America, as their backyard. Ortega, however, expressed hope that imperialism cannot last any longer. On sanctions, Latin American leaders echoed the stance of the Iranian foreign minister, who called such measures terrorist threat being used by imperial powers as leverage. They stressed the need for boosting cooperation in trade and technology, among other things, to overcome those curbs. It seems that shared challenges have brought these countries together to push against U.S. hegemony. And what could make a difference? Moving away from the U.S. dollar, establishing a common currency, enhancing bilateral and multilateral trade. It seems that an oriental shift is largely taking place in today's world. That is visible in countries on the African continent that are trying to enhance ties with the East, namely Russia and China, and Latin American nations that are standing firm against U.S. unilateralism. All these point to their rejection of Western hegemony.
Elsewhere, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has pledged to expand military drills and beef up the country's war readiness posture. Kim was speaking at a meeting of the Central Military Commission of the ruling Workers' Party. The officials discussed major military and political tasks for this year. North Korea is expected to stage a military parade on Wednesday to mark the founding anniversary of its armed forces. Tensions have been rising on the Korean Peninsula in recent months. Last week, Pyongyang condemned the drills by the U.S., South Korea, and Japan. North Korea says the war games have reached, quote, an extreme red line and threaten to turn the Korean Peninsula into a war zone. This as Washington has vowed to deploy more aircraft carriers and long-range bombers to the region to counter North Korea's weapons development. Our correspondent in Seoul, Frank Smith, joined us earlier. He said Pyongyang's pursuit of nuclear weapons can be viewed as deterrence.
Well, I think really that's kind of the irony here, is that it's the U.S. and South Korea that claim that it's North Korea that's exacerbating tensions here. Even if you, you know, calculate North Korea's military capability, while they do have, you know, more soldiers in arms, the North Korean military is really no match technologically for the South Korean military, and in any stretch of the imagination, for the U.S.-South Korea alliance and its pursuit of nuclear weapons really can be viewed as deterrence. There has been 28,500 U.S. troops on the Korean Peninsula stationed here. You know, it had been previously been more, but for the last 20 years or so, that's been the force deployed here in South Korea, periodically, again, engaging in these large-scale exercises. At the same time, some analysts suggest this tension between South Korea and North Korea and between the U.S. and North Korea really gives the U.S. an excuse to deploy its military to the region largely as a means of containing China. So there is a lot sort of regionally going on behind this tension between North Korea and South Korea and even the U.S. and North Korea.
And that brings an end to the World Bulletin for this hour.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we briefly discussed Imam Khomeini's return from Paris to Iran a few days after the Shah's escape from the country. Today, we are going to relate the story of his arrival in Iran. After 14 years of exile, Imam Khomeini arrived in Iran on February 2, 1979. The companions of Imam were very concerned and restless as they thought of the possibility of terrorist attempts or bombing plots against the Imam during the trip. Although the last prime minister of the regime, Shapur Bakhtiar, had agreed with the landing of the Air France flight in Tehran, there were rumors among people of a conspiracy to assassinate the Imam. Some said that the airplane would explode in the air. Others spoke of the likelihood of changing the course of the airplane and abducting the Imam. However, people in the country were looking at the sky, waiting for Imam Khomeini's flight to appear. The streets leading to Mehrabad Airport were full of millions of lovers who had gathered enthusiastically to welcome their beloved leader. Hundreds of stands were set up to distribute sweets and candies among people. Yet, the only face which was unchanged and serene was the face of Imam Khomeini, as he was sitting in the airplane in complete calm. He was so calm that when a reporter asked him of his feeling in those moments, he only answered, "Nothing." This was so amazing that the reporter didn't ask any other question. Nevertheless, the Imam's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, was very worried and preoccupied with the thought of Imam's healthy flight to Iran. She would think if the regime would let him free or would arrest and imprison him. Would the Imam's security be guaranteed during the flight? Would he be secure at the airport and his transfer from the airport to the place of his speech? Would his life be guaranteed among the swarming population in Behesht-e Zahra Cemetery? Where would be his place of residence? These and scores of other thoughts had occupied the mind of the Imam's wife. When the news of Imam Khomeini's health reached his wife in Paris, she sighed in relief and thanked God for this great bounty. After his arrival in Iran and residing at Alavi School, Imam Khomeini asked Ayatollah Mutahhari to make the preparations for his wife's return to the country. Thus, 2 days later, the lady left Paris for Tehran. In the first days, the Imam's wife was residing at a different place due to the big number of people who came to visit the Imam. At first, women were not allowed to visit the Imam. But soon, Imam Khomeini asked those in charge to determine certain days for women's visit. Therefore, the Imam and his wife could meet one another in special intervals. In view of this, many ladies, as soon as getting informed of Ms. Saghafi's residence, eagerly rushed to visit her. Imam Khomeini's daughter, Zahra Mustafavi, says in this regard, "When my mother resided in this house and the locals and other women were informed of her presence, rushed to meet her. My mother would sit on a bench and the visitors would come in a long queue to greet and meet her. Some of them, who were closer relatives or old friends of the lady, would sit in the room for formal reception and some of them would stay for lunch or dinner. My mother's warm welcome and smile was very memorable for all who met her." Dear listeners, on February 9th, just 3 days before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, a group of the Air Force officers came to Imam Khomeini's residence as a sign of their allegiance to him. Indeed, it was as a parade before the Imam. This parade was registered by Hossein Partovi, the skilled photographer, who took the photo from the back of the officers not to be recognized by the agents of the regime. The photo of the Air Force officers was published on Kayhan newspaper. This once more revived the hope of victory in the hearts of the people, while the puppet premier of the regime, Shapur Bakhtiar, was scared and panicked. When the newspaper was taken to the imam's wife, she mentioned two important points. Firstly, the prime minister would no longer rely on the Air Force, and secondly, the photo was both artistic and epic. She even tried to estimate the number of the officers from the photo. The next day, a group of the Shah Special Guards attacked the Air Force officers to avenge their parade. The news of this move soon was spread everywhere, and people confronted the guards till the next morning. When the imam's wife heard the people's support for the Air Force officers, she prayed so that all events would end in victory. Thank God, the Islamic Revolution triumphed and the enemies were frustrated.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Britain is facing yet another strike. This is the largest ever healthcare strike due to pay disputes. Health workers are demanding a pay rise that reflects the worst inflation in Britain in four decades, and also to deal with the cost of living crisis. The government says that would be unaffordable and will not be able to meet this demand. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the UK's precarious economic predicament, one affected by inflation and a cost of living crisis, while plagued with massive protests, which will continue to disrupt the economy even further. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Fab Benzies, researcher and political economy analyst, joins us from London. Also joining us, Shabir Rizvi, economic analyst, who also joins us from London. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Fab Benzies, first over to you. So we're looking at the largest ever strike by health workers. And just prior to this broadcast, taking a look at some of the towns that are involved here, it seems like towns are added to the list of places where these nurses are striking. And it's not the first strike, but the health sector, which is over the pay rise, amongst other things, actually. Tell us what you think about this, first of all, and I guess in a bigger picture, what's going to happen if neither side gives in, whether it's an offer by the government and then the nurses are not going to go for it, or vice versa?
Thanks for having me back on. The thing is, we tend to focus on news stories as they emerge, and that's not surprising. This is a news channel. But one needs to look at the bigger picture, as you've alluded to, because this is structural. And all of this that is now coming to everyone's notice has been long predictable, as I've said before on your program. And the problem is that if one's addressing the symptoms of a structural issue, one's only playing whack-a-mole, which you may know is a children's game where you have a hammer and you hit things down and other things pop up. And that essentially is what is happening in the way our government responds to the crises as they emerge into public consciousness. And nobody is actually addressing the fundamental structural problems which are related to money. As far as where we go from here, I suspect that we're just going to head further into dysfunction because we as we said 7 or 8 years ago, we're heading for economic collapse, and there is no monetary or fiscal measures available in the toolbox anymore. They've used them all. They've printed all the money they can without really causing runaway inflation, which is probably inevitable anyway. And they can't raise taxes because people are strapped in any event. So in the last 3 years, they basically sabotaged the economy, and we're now paying the price. But what will happen and what is happening is the structure will change, money will change, and the way we handle value will change. But that's a much bigger debate.
Well, I think this particular sector is obviously something that needs to be somewhat resolved, and rather quickly, because time is running out, Shabir Rizvi, if you agree. And I'm going to tell you why, based on this one particular piece of news, which it's been contested, but it's still shocking because the numbers could be this high. And the source of this said, it's a website that said up to 500 people dying each week from emergency care delays, the bad flu season compounding with systemic problems leading to unnecessary deaths, a patient waiting 99 hours for a bed at Great Western Hospital in Swindon, which is one of the most extreme cases. So if we're looking at that, along with the fact that you're looking at nurses leaving en masse because of a decade of poor pay, 25,000 to have left just last year, you have a problem. People are dying. So this needs to somehow be resolved, doesn't it?
Thank you very much. A pleasure to be back again, Kaveh. Look, as my colleague described, that it's a structural problem. And not only is it a structural problem, I think it's more an ideological and a political conundrum that the government is in. We've had a Tory government now in power, as I have commented previously, for the last 13 years. They have presided over the most stringent form of austerity measures. And what austerity meant was that, you know, the poor people had to, or the lower income people had to tighten their belt. And we were told the sort of story that we are all in it together. In reality, it's only the top 1% who were not in it together. And as we know, over the pandemic, over the last 2 years, the rich and the wealthy have had their wealth increase twice as much, whilst the poor working, you know, the nurses, the firemen, the you know, people working in the railway services, they've all had to sort of have less income in relation to what inflation has done to their income. But I think the important thing is that, yes, deaths are occurring, and this could be sort of, if you like, the you know, the effect of the pandemic as well, because for the last 2 years, you know, the cancer patients, the people who've got cardiac issues, older people with multiple sort of health issues have not been sort of seen to in a proper way. I understand that the figure is about 1 million visits, which are outstanding, which have to come through the pipeline. So all those aspects are having an impact. But I think, you know, the government always talks about we don't have the money to sort of give 10%, 12% increase to the employees working in the state sector. We have about 5.5 million people working in the state sector in the UK. But we can find the money to send to Ukraine. We are continuously sort of pumping money in that war. So if that money were not being sort of wasted in that direction, people could be paid better salaries here. And, you know, the whole issue could be resolved very easily. But the, as I said, it's a political and an ideological issue whereby the Tory government always feels that the poor should sort of feel the pain more than the wealthy. And they have gone in that direction for the last 13 years continuously, and the poor have become poorer. And we have, as you know, other commentators and myself have said, that in UK we have over 5 million people going to the food banks. These are working poor, if you like. They don't have enough income to be able to sort of feed their families. Right. And with the cost of living crisis and the sort of energy bills that are coming through the door, that is putting a huge pressure on people's purses, hence they want more money so that they can have a reasonable living standard.
Sure. Well, maybe it's a good time to ask this question, Clive Menzies, as to the structure that exists in the, for example, the public health sector vis-a-vis the private sector for health services in terms of going to private, I guess, either doctors or what have you to deal with health-related issues. Because as it is, if we're looking at this many deaths happening in a week, I would call that an emergency situation. But maybe because people can't afford it. And I'm asking this question because Shabir Rizvi talked about how you know, the poor obviously can't afford going to a private doctor maybe, and they need to go to a public doctor. Is that how it works in the UK? And if that's the case, the bigger question is based on a statement by one analyst is that the government is doing this on purpose because they want to privatize the health system. Is that the case?
Well, there's a lot of questions to explore there. First, on the question of excess deaths, not only the excess deaths arising due to stress on the NHS itself, but the NHS has been complicit in promoting excess death through an elephant in the room that nobody is discussing, and that's people dying through vaccination. Post-mortem data is coming out in droves in that fashion. And the I'm not sure what the current number is, but our excess death numbers every week are way in excess of the averages. So it's not purely down to the inadequacy of the NHS. As far as private healthcare is concerned, there was a secret report produced, I think, around 2005 that was leaked. And basically, when Thatcher left office, who would never have dared try and privatise the NHS, the management costs, in other words, the non-medical costs, were 3%. By 2005, that had risen to 14% as more and more layers of management were put into the NHS. And the American model, which is the insured model, at that time was 20%. I suspect it's larger now because you have the Obama healthcare, the Obamacare provisions. So private provision or public provision is not really the issue here. And there is a much deeper issue as to whether our healthcare system, the conventional allopathic medical system, is fit for purpose, because actually the primary responsibility for one's health is oneself. And there is much that we can do personally to avoid taking medications that are harmful, mm-hmm. to eat healthily, to not do all the things that are bad for us. So this is a very wide-ranging discussion that goes sure. way beyond money, but money is the medium by which everything is being mediated. And as Shabir has said, you know, we've got money galore for the green agenda and all sorts of, in Britain, our freedoms are being curtailed by remodeling of the roads to cut out car usage. So all this money is being spent. Okay. It's not been spent in the right way.
Right. Well, let's move on to a broader picture here when it comes to strikes, Shabir Rizvi. I mean, the UK is, if I may use the word plague, is plagued with strikes because we're looking at what happened last year and now through this new year, which is not so new anymore. Just last week, you had 500,000 who went on a strike, the largest strike in over a decade, teachers, civil servants, train drivers, and university lecturers. You can't have a country that keeps going on strikes in the volume and the numbers that the UK is experiencing. And you have the Prime Minister saying, well, pay rises need to be reasonable and affordable, and issuing a warning that big pay rises would jeopardize attempts to tame inflation. I mean, what does he call big pay rises? If you have 10% inflation on paper, or 11, and some say it's going to go up to 20.
Well, look, at the end of the day, the classical economist will tell you that wage price inflation is what Britain is in at this moment. If wages or salaries increase by what inflation is, that will feed into more inflation, and then you'd have a vicious cycle of higher and higher inflation. That's one sort of economic theory, if you like, which is being sort of pushed forward by the government because it thinks from an economic model whereby that approach is being applied. However, on the other hand, just looking at sort of healthcare, particularly, Britain still spends only between 8 and 9% of the GDP on healthcare. Whilst if you have the US model, which is an insurance-based model, they spend 19 to 20% of the GDP on healthcare. So really, I just often when I think about this, I really can't fathom how the private healthcare model is a success. Yes, it is argued that, you know, if you pay for the money, therefore you can get the operations done quicker and you don't have to sort of wait for your turn. So there's a rationing, if you like, in UK through the waiting list, but in the US and other countries where you have insurance, it's sort of rationing by money, if you like. If you have money, you can get the things done. But at a sort of bigger sort of level, the question that you were posing, that yes, it is quite an interesting situation that we have at this moment, that many professions which never took strike action, particularly the nurses, which for the first time in their history were taking strike action, and then you had university professors, as you said, university lecturers and so on, and other sort of public sector employees who are taking action on a regular basis. So Britain is in a sort of a difficult situation. And I think what the ruling elite is trying to do is what Margaret Thatcher did 40 years ago to muzzle the unions. Margaret Thatcher took on the miners' union at that time and completely destroyed the mining communities. And 40 years later, certain parts of the UK, which were based on, the economies were based on coal mine, they got coal mines, they're still sort of suffering 40 years later, two generations later.
Right.
So what I think this government is doing, and there is discussion now that they want to pass new legislation whereby strike action will not be allowed. There will be sort of other restrictions whereby taking a strike action would not be easy. Therefore, what they're trying to do, I suspect, through this particular approach is to incapacitate the unions and the power that they may have at this moment to fight for their members and demand better income and better sort of quality of work.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Right. Well, that's been a controversial issue, Clive Menzies, if you agree, the way that the government is introducing legislation to stop the strike action. But they've applied that to, sectors that involve either health or security, to put it in a general sense here. But in terms of the government response is what I want to ask you. I'm looking at the statement made by Sharon Graham, leader of the Unite Union. She has said that she wanted Sunak to come to the negotiating table, and she says this government is putting lives at risk. Rishi Sunak has said, I have held constructive talks with the trade unions on pay and affordability and continue to urge them to call off the strikes. Either Sunak is not saying the truth or Sharon Graham is not. Which is it, do you think?
Well, I think they're both operating under an illusion, and I'm not convinced that unions are what they were 40 years ago. I think they're very much part of the problem. What we're witnessing through these strikes and what we saw through COVID was the deliberate, premeditated destruction of the economy. Shabir mentioned wage push inflation, which was a reality in the 1970s. I don't think it's something we can ignore. But I think as far as the percentage we spend on healthcare is concerned, and he was comparing that with 19% America, for America, that is not much of that is actually going on healing people. Most of it is going into those that control money, who control the pharmaceutical industry, the oil industry, and every other industry. So in terms of how do we bridge this gap between Sunak and Sharon, I didn't catch her second name.
It's okay.
It's an irreconcilable gap at the current stage. It is inevitable, and you talk about inflation of 10%. I would suggest to you that for a large proportion of the poorer people, inflation is much higher. And average inflation statistics are invariably misleading, as are many statistics, because within those averages are a huge number of different experiences. And our research would suggest that inflation is probably running much higher than claimed okay. by the official figures.
All right. Since we're running out of time here, I'm trying to understand, based on my thoughts, where to go with you, Shabir Rizvi, on my next question. And all I could come up with here is when you take a look at the different economic factors or indicators of the UK, it doesn't look good. So my question to you is a headline that I read, which is really quite shocking in a sense. It talked about the lost decade, where the UK may be facing a lost decade of growth if action isn't taken to address the different issues that it's dealing with. And it really looked at business investment and also worker shortages. First of all, do you think that the UK has reached a point or is going down a path that it may lead to a lost decade? Explain to us what that means. We know that Japan went through it. And also, what is the government actually shaping itself to deal with it if this is a path that the UK is going down in?
Well, not only are we facing a lost decade, but we've had a lost decade which has just gone by since the financial crisis of 2008. More than a decade has been lost, where the standard of living of the ordinary people has been reduced drastically, where working conditions have deteriorated, where people are working longer hours. Some people are doing two or multiple jobs to ends meet. And then on top of that, you have crisis upon crisis. The whole sort of COVID issue, as my colleague has quite eloquently pointed out, has had its impact. But the real issue is, as I keep sort of reminding your viewers, is that there is a fundamental problem in the UK, the way the political system and the economic system is operating. It is operating in the interest of 1%. And that 1% really, or even less than 1%, is not very much interested in the ordinary people. What British government or the Tory parties would like is, as some people have said, that Singapore on the Thames, whereby there is very little sort of regulation, and then the employees are exploited as much as possible. However, Singapore has a different model, and they've done very well in some ways for their population. Mm-hmm. But here we have a 70 million population. We have disparity between north and south of the United Kingdom. We have within London pockets of extreme poverty.
Okay.
If you walk anywhere in London at this time or over the last previous few years, people are sleeping on the streets as well.
If it's that bad, and I'm guessing it is since you're saying that, Shabir Rizvi, Clive Menzies, do you think that the line has been crossed? This strike that took place last week, it was very telling because you had so many people, and they were all standing, and I think they were looking down at Downing Street, if I'm not mistaken. But they were just standing, and the looks on their faces, it looked like desperation in a sense. They want their situation to be resolved. Are we looking at a point where the 1%, if the government favors them, that's not going to matter because people are going to get desperate and numbers are going to overwhelm that 1%? Quickly, if you can, under a minute.
Okay. The government isn't in control, and looking to the government to resolve this probably isn't going to work. The Labour Party, led by Keir Starmer, he's a member of the Trilateral Commission, which is one of these global think tanks, and they're all following the same script. The only way that this is going to change is through structural change, and that is people taking back responsibility for themselves and each other and helping each other, because the systems of government and the structures that are provided are no longer fit for purpose.
Thank you. Thank you, Claude Menzies, researcher and political economy analyst from London, and also from London, Shabir Rizvi, economic analyst. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitapoy and the team, it's goodbye.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. I have a very special guest speaker for today's discussion, Shaykh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
That's right. For today's discussion, we'll continue, our talk regarding the justice of the Sahabi of Prophet Muhammad, especially from the viewpoints of Ahlul Sunnah, because they believe that, of course, most of the Ahlul Sunnah theorists believe that the Sahabi of Prophet Muhammad were just, so they are truly guided, and the people are allowed to follow them because they might go to heaven. In the previous discussion, we talked about some of the ayahs of the Holy Quran. Now, in this episode, let's get to the Ravayat or the narrations. What are they, Sheikh Karimi?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Let me clarify one point here, and that is the fact that we are not talking about, we are not claiming that all the companions of the Prophet were sinful. I mean, none of them were justice. No, of course, based on both Shia and Sunni sources, we have some companions of the Prophet, the best of whom is for sure Imam Ali alayhi salam, who have so many virtues and merits, and we can prove the infallibility of them through verses of the Quran and the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, both in Shia and Sunni sources, like Ayatul Tathir and the narrations about this verse in both Shia and Sunni sources. But the point is that our Sunni brothers believe that all the companions of the Prophet, without any exception, they are just, and we can follow any of them. And we, as Shia, we have problem with these generalization, the claim that all the companions of the Prophet are just. In the previous session, I recited some of the verses of the Quran, according to which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has reprimanded some of the companions of the Prophet. And in today's session, I would like to share some narrations from Sunni sources to reject this claim.
That's right.
Now, in his Sahih Bukhari has a chapter called Babun fil Hawd, which is about the famous pond or Hawd on the Day of Judgment. And he narrates about 10 narrations. In all of them, the Holy Prophet is blaming and complaining about his Sahaba or companions. For example, I'm talking about Sahih Bukhari, the most authentic collection of hadith in the eyes of our Sunni brothers. According to one narration, the Holy Prophet is quoted as saying, "On the Day of Judgment, some people come to me next to the pond of Kauthar or next to the pond. I know all of them and they know me," meaning that they are among my companions.
Okay.
"Then there would be a separation between me and them. Then I will tell God that they are, I mean, my companions, they are from me. But then I am told, or I will be told, that you do not know what they have done after you. Then I would say, be away from me, those who made some changes in my religion." In another narration, the Holy Prophet is quoted as saying that on the Day of Judgment, some group are brought before me, they are among my companions, and then they are going to be taken toward the hell. And I ask for the reason, then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that after you, they became apostate. There are several narrations to this effect that the Holy Prophet has foretold, has predicted that after me, some of my companions would become apostate or murtad.
That's right.
Abu Sa'id Khidri, in another narration, says that once we were before the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, and he was dividing some maybe public territory among the Muslims. Then a man from Bani Tamim came, and his name is Dhul Khuwaisara. He's one of the companions of the Prophet. And addressing the Prophet, he said that, "Oh, Messenger of God, practice justice."
Yes.
As if the Holy Prophet is oppressing the people in dividing the territory or That's the right. booties of the war. And then the Holy Prophet told him that if I'm not going to practice justice, then who is able to do so? The second caliph asked the Prophet for permission to kill him. And the Holy Prophet said that no, he did not allow him. And then the Holy Prophet said that there are other people, other companions of me, that they recite the Quran, but they do not act upon it, and they will go outside the religion of Islam, meaning that they will become apostate after me.
That's right.
In another narration, Ala bin Musayyib, I'm just quoting from Sunni sources, Ala bin Musayyib quotes his father as saying that, "I met Bara bin Azib, one of the famous companions of the Prophet, and I told him that good for you, because of the fact that you accompanied the Prophet and even you paid allegiance to him under the tree, the famous allegiance or bay'ah of Shajara. And then he told me that you do not know what we did after him and what deviation we made in the religion of Islam." The next point is that, according to some narrations in Sunni sources, the companions of the Prophet themselves did not believe in justice of the other companions of the Prophet. So, for example, we have some cases in which one companion of the Prophet asked the permission from the Prophet to kill the other companion or to behead him. We have, today I think I shared two narrations in which the second caliph tried to do so, tried to ask the permission from the Prophet to kill another companion of the Prophet, which requires that in the eyes of the second caliph, that companion should be killed. So is it true to claim that all the companions of the Prophet were just? Not only that, some of the companions of the Prophet used to curse other companions of the Prophet. The best example is Muawiyah.